Welcome to Sacred Allegiance, the podcast. I'm Max Kohler.
And I'm Pat LaMarche.
Sacred Allegiance is dedicated to recognizing secular saints. We're huge Kurt Vonnegut fans, and he coined the phrase secular saints for people behaving decently in a shockingly indecent society. We also host the website, sacredallegiance.org, where you can listen to interviews we've conducted. If you have a personal organization we should know about, use our contact form on the website to let us know.
Hey, Max, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really excited for our guest today.
As am I. Thank you for bringing him in.
You know, one of Kurt Vonnegut's heroes was Eugene V. Debs, who ran for president from prison famously and did actually quite well. And one of the things he said was, "While there is a soul in prison, I am not free." And I don't think a lot of people understand that because they think, well, people go to jail, they belong in jail, right? Why in the world should that be a hindrance to me? But our guest today, Salim Holbrook, is going to chat with us about the awful insanity of putting a 16-year-old in prison to begin with. That's just, and then what happens when that 16-year-old spends the majority of his adult life behind bars. So Salim, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Pat and Max, for having me on the show.
Welcome. And then with you is Anita Colon, your sister, who we're going to start with you, Salim, but I can't wait to get to Anita and see if we can hear maybe some of her recollections of that day that her brother was taken to jail. Salim, thanks and welcome to the show. And do you want to just give us a little bit of some background? I met you because I was working on a story about solitary confinement. I was witness to a testimony you gave to the Pennsylvania legislature about solitary confinement and why it needs to end, period. Mm-hmm. Most of the lawmakers there were thinking, oh, well, we could give people a little more time out in the yard, which wasn't the intention. It was ending solitary confinement. And you yourself spent 10 years, 10 of 27 years in solitary confinement, the longest time, 3 years straight.
Yes.
So first of all, do you want to give us just a brief synopsis of being a 16-year-old kid and getting tossed in the clink and then finding out what the world was going to be like?
Yeah, it's really strange when I reflect back on that, because it's almost like I'm reflecting on a different person, you know, to actually think about, you know, I could tell you definitively who I was 10 and 20 years ago, maybe even 25 years ago when I was in my 20s, you know, but going back to who I was when I was 14, 15, 16 years old, I really can't, because those were those formative years where you were just struggling to find yourself, you know, to be comfortable with yourself. But what it was like to be thrown into the state prison at the age of 16, I got to really start with what got me to that point, because I always, one of the things I shared and I wrote an article about it was being in solitary confinement for so long, really, all you have time to do is reflect, because if you don't, you could go crazy. And I actually had the ability really to reflect on all of the decisions that landed me to be sitting in a courtroom at the age of 16 facing the death sentence. And that really just all started with just bad decisions I made. When I was around 14 and a half, 15 years old, drugs was really heavy in the neighborhoods. Really, it rolled through. It rolled through a lot earlier, but it became a lot more prevalent to me at that age, right? Because I was a kid moving out of the adolescence, going into that 15, 16-year-old age. And I could vividly recall going to school, and there were other guys my age who were involved in selling drugs. And they would come to school every day with new clothes, fresh sneakers, gold chains, the latest Gazelles or Alpina glasses. And, you know, as a kid, you know, you're attracted to that. And I seen girls at school attracted to that, right? These guys are pulling out wads of hundreds of dollars in the hallway and everyone is congregating around them. And they're my age, right? That's another thing. And, you know, I came from a working class family, a single working class mother who worked her tail off to provide. So I can't sit here and say I was going to school and beat up clothes and beat up sneakers and stuff like that. But my mother couldn't provide that, right? Because she was working class. I had a younger brother. So she provided enough that I didn't come up in poverty, but we lived week to week. And she did do what she could to provide for us with clothing and what we wanted. Christmas was always, there was a lot of toys under the Christmas tree, and she always struggled. But I was really attracted to that. And it was just that era. You know, it was the era of Miami Vice, Scarface. You know, I like to tell people that, you know, white kids were able to go off to Wall Street to make their fortune. Whereas though in black and brown communities that I came from, we went off to 18th Street to make our fortunes. Mm-hmm. And that was where I went to, 18th Street, around my old neighborhood, 18th and Wallace. I wanted those gold chains. I wanted to go to school every day like those kids with a new pair of sneakers, with gold chains, with wads of money. And so what I did was, you know, the people have this ideal that drug dealers recruit kids. They don't. The lifestyle recruits kids. And so I knew that that was what they were doing. So what I did was just walked up to the corner, and I was one of the young dudes from the neighborhood, and just complimented the drug dealer's car. And I knew that that was the start to my introduction into that lifestyle, right? They don't stand outside. They don't have to do that. You know, that's like the bull crap PSA public service announcement that they play in Cambria County, Bucks County, or those places. As we say, the lifestyle is the recruitment tool.
Can I just throw something in real quick, Salim? The other thing we do is we take kids who live marginally and we punish them if they get a decent job. So if a kid is living in HUD subsidized housing, housing and urban development housing, and their parents are just getting by and they've got a subsidy so they can live there, if that kid goes out and gets a job at Burger King, they have to count the kid's income towards the parent's income, and the parent can lose their housing.
Absolutely.
And so what happens is we tell young kids, if you get a job, a decent job, a legal job, you're putting your entire family at risk. So the only job we allow these kids to have, if they want a decent or a new pair of sneakers or a gold chain, but even less, right? Just simple, you know, I mean, we right now are about to welcome a president that has gold toilet seats, and yet we're not supposed to want a 16-year-old to want something, right? Absolutely. To want a nicer thing.
Yeah.
And commercialism is everything. So we tell these kids, if you get that job, that you, basically the only job you can get is an illegal job.
Definitely. And I think, too, that another side of that, too, is that, you know, youth are allowed for mistakes, right? And so I really couldn't see a path to a legal job. And I think that, I'll be honest with you, if it was put in front of me at that point in my life, I wouldn't have taken it, because I knew enough to know that that legal job was not going to get me that Nissan Maxima, that Toyota Point 8, those things that I wanted, because I seen that Chevy Blazer, these guys in my neighborhood. But I didn't go into it to harm anyone. However, I was a little young hothead, and what attracted me to a lot of guys was that I was one of those guys that was willing to throw down at a dime, and that really attracts drug dealers. I tell people that children are expendable when it comes to the drug game, and that's what I was. I was a soldier, and you know, people talk about the military. Why do they call infantry infantry? If you go back to the definition of infantry, there's a reason why, because they were the youngest troops. They didn't really have life experience, and they could send them in waves into an opposition that someone older would be like, hell no, I'm not going. I know what's down that path. Whereas though these younger ones, they're all just hotheading and blasting full steam ahead. And the drug game is the same way. It was the children, it was the younger guys that died the most and went to prison the most. And I was one of those casualties. And unfortunately, I was involved in a drug-related homicide in my neighborhood, literally only 6 months after getting involved in the drug game. That's how quick my descent was to where I left my sister's house. I was living at her house. I ran away. And it was only a period of 6 months. I went from being in school, going to school every day. Don't get me wrong, I wasn't getting the best grades, right? I was a below average student, probably even a D student, but I was going to school every day to running away. 6 months later, I was facing the death sentence for being involved in a drug related homicide. I served as a lookout to that murder. It was both the victim and the us, the offenders, were all from the same neighborhood. We all, unfortunately, knew each other. The victim was innocent. So it was really, like, for me, I really had to do some soul searching over the years. But to your point, facing the death sentence, I really couldn't comprehend it. I can't tell you that I was scared, because I hadn't lived yet. I felt like I was a passenger or a actor in someone else's script, that I was just moving along, because the attorney, most of his conversations was with my parents, with my sister. He would come back and talk to me, but the whole process of the court system is not designed for a 16-year-old, right? And in my case, happened on my 16th birthday. So I felt like I was on autopilot. I remember when they delivered the so in Pennsylvania, if you're facing the death sentence, they have to serve capital notice on you, and that they intend to pursue capital charges. And it's full of pageantry, right? To say the least. The guards come to your cell, two guards as an escort, one guard holding a certified letter. They open your door, bring it to you, open the letter in front of you, ask you to sign the certified mail form, watch you open it, and then they turn around and walk out. And it's only two lines. It basically said the state of Commonwealth versus Robert Holbrook. The state intends to pursue capital charges pursuant to first degree murder against Robert Holbrook. And I'll be honest with you, I just looked at it and was like, okay, damn, they're trying to sentence me to death. But yeah, I was oblivious, you know? And then even when I went to trial and ultimately I was found guilty and sentenced to life without parole, I remember walking back and forth in the holding cell at City Hall in Philadelphia, just trying to comprehend what life without parole meant, what life in prison meant. And I couldn't. You know, I remember when my lawyer was telling me, look, you could get 10 years, you could get 20 years. I could comprehend that because I looked at my sister's fiance at the time, Israel, who was 26, 27 years old. So I was like, okay, damn, I'll be his age when I'm eligible for release. But life, I just couldn't, I just walked in, it just landed like a blank thud on me. So yeah. I really never comprehended the totality of my sentence until I would say 7 years, 8 years into my sentence, when I started getting into my early 20s and seeing so many people going home, and then I'm 10 years in prison. And it's like, I'm no closer to going to home or getting out than the first day I entered. Then I started like, oh, okay, damn, this is serious. Like, they're trying to leave me in here for life. So,
So let's just take a minute maybe and then go to Anita before we get too far beyond that day that you were arrested. And Anita, do you want to pick up? He had been living with you. Are you the sister he was living with? You have just one.
Not only one. Yes. Yeah. yeah, it's funny because when you said that earlier, I don't have as much recollection of the day that he was arrested as I do of it being in court and guilty verdict and all of that. Like, that is what I look back on and what is more, you know, just monumental, you know, for me is just that whole experience. I mean, obviously him being arrested was traumatic. But I think it was just more, even when you're, you know, arrested, I mean, you know, the reality is that kids and teens can get arrested. So like, that's just not really the traumatic. It's when you've met with lawyers, and it's just like this idea that this little boy, because me, it was like little boy, barely 16 years old, again, this had occurred right on his birthday, could be facing a death penalty. You know, or life, it was incredulous. Like it made absolutely no sense to me. So trying to just sort of wrap my head around that, you know, my mother, all of us trying to wrap our head around that. And then when the judge actually gave him the sentence, actually sentenced him and said, you know, life without the possibility of parole. And we cried, my aunt, my mom, you know, me, my stepfather, who's Rob Salim's father, was there. And Rooney kept saying, like, well, how long is that? But how many years? Because life isn't life in most states. You know, New Jersey, New York, everybody's like, so 20 years? Is that what you're saying? And it was just like, no. Like, what do you get? Like, life. And it was just, it was just unbelievable that this child that, you know, hadn't even had an opportunity to get a driver's license, that they could be saying that the rest of his life he should be taken from society. So that's what I remember distinctly. I can close my, I don't even have to close my eyes to see what that courtroom looked like, to see what my mother, you know, looked like, to remember, to see my brother, you know, looking across at him. So it was just hard to believe.
Was there anyone who was trying to help your family or him? I mean, I don't even know if there would be in the courts today. I mean, obviously, there's,
you mean like an advocate.
Yeah, or like anyone who's like, wow, what your family's about to go through is.
No, absolutely not. There was no one. And even after, at that point, there was no one. You know, my mom had to find, you know, those types of, you know, support groups and organizations on her own. Yeah, there was absolutely nothing.
That leads me to the question then. So, and kind of back to Salim. So obviously you had to kind of become an advocate for yourself. And I think, Anita, you were a big advocate for Salim as well. What led you down that path?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, well, like Anita said, that my mom always had like a social justice bent. She was a very fierce anti-apartheid activist. She was really involved in the social justice and radical movements in the 70s in Philadelphia. And when I went to prison, you know, she would always send me books to read. She sent me the autobiography of Malcolm X, several other books, books about Nelson Mandela. And so I read those, and they were very influential in my life, right, in terms of allowing me just to kind of reconnect with what was in the home that I didn't take advantage of, that I couldn't see because of everything I was chasing on the outside. You know, the values that me and Anita came up with were, even from my father, were family values. You know, they may have been a little bit, in some areas, a little dysfunctional, but we came up in a good, loving home. And when I deviated from those values by getting involved in the street life, one thing I realized was that I had to kind of invert myself, put myself back upright. And so the reading really was instrumental in that. But I also, too, I was very fortunate to be mentored by prisoners in Pennsylvania, some of them who were actual political prisoners, members of the Black Panther Party, Black Liberation Army, who went to prison in the 60s and 70s. And when I came through, all of them were buried in the hole, but I was getting into a lot of problems because I just really couldn't adjust those early years. And I would meet them in the hole, and they really changed my insight. They really gave me a understanding of what social justice is. They gave me an understanding of what class is, poverty is. One of the things I could vividly recall is, you know, I was Russell Maroon Schultz, who was a member of the Black Liberation Army and Black Panther Party. He spent 50 something years in prison. We actually got him out under Compassionate Release, the Abolitionist Law Center, so that he could go home and pass with his family. But I do remember running into him, and I remember a conversation that we had when I was younger. And I said that, I'm a rider from my neighborhood. Like, we was talking about something, but I remember I was like, yeah, I'm here for riding from my neighborhood, right? And riding means basically like, I'm here representing my neighborhood. I'm someone who defends my neighborhood. And I remember him vividly. And, you know, I'm a young hothead now at the time. I'm probably 19, 20, you know, caught up in the street. I mean, caught up in the prison culture. But I really remember him setting me straight in a way that really was impactful for me. He said, you're not a rider for your neighborhood. You're in here for harming someone from your own neighborhood. He said, you want to know what a rider is for the neighborhood? You don't want to know, you want to know who someone is that defends their neighborhood? when I was out there in the streets, when the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Army was home, we defended our communities. We fed people. We had free clinics, health clinics. We had free food for children going to school. He said, we had armed patrols in our neighborhood so that people could walk around the communities, particularly elders at night, and not feel unsafe. Oh, and by the way, we also held police accountable. I'm in here, you know, he told me about what he was in here for. And I kind of actually didn't believe him. I kind of was like, I respected him, but I was like, you were part of a armed underground organization that had shootouts and went to war with police because they killed Black people in the community. That, you know, I didn't hear that much of that growing up. But then when I actually read about the Black Panthers, Black Liberation Army, and what they were doing, and then read about him, I was like, okay, Dan, this guy's for real. But he wasn't a gangster. He wasn't someone that was trying to teach me to take advantage of and harm people and embrace the prison culture, be a predator, that all those traits that prison promotes and instills in you. He was doing me the opposite. He was teaching me empathy, you know? And prison is an environment where you are cold, but he's teaching me empathy. He's teaching me about the value of helping other people, helping your community. And that really was a pivot point for me, or a fork in the road point for me, because like Anita said, my mother and Anita and family members always supported me just on the strength of being family. But I do believe that there was a period in probably my mid-20s where they saw actual change in me and who I was becoming. I started writing. I started taking a lot of leadership and advocacy that really got them motivated to get more involved. And it almost felt like we were a conspiracy. We were like a collective struggle to not just free me, but to free others, but also to deal with issues of social injustice in this country. So that's, you know, was part of what you could call my evolutionary journey behind bars. It started in prison. Who I am today, what we built today, the Abolitionist Law Center, the Human Rights Coalition, many of those organizations, Pat, that you saw testify at that hearing against solitary confinement, actually started from inside the prison cells, but through outside collaboration with activists like my sister, Brett Grody, who's our legal director, ALC's legal director, brilliant, one of the most brilliant legal minds in the country, argued the case in front of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to abolish felony murder in Pennsylvania, right? And felony murder is that category of murder where you could just be the lookout driver and spend the rest of your life in prison if someone kills someone and jumps in your cars and for robbing someone. He was just a regular volunteer before he went to law school. And me and him collaborated going back to 2007, 2008. So this whole movement really was a result of inside-outside collaboration. And it was grounded in values. And it was grounded in that empathy that Russell Maroon Schultz and other political prisoners, as well as other prisoners who went to prison and just changed themselves, really helped instill in me, particularly as a kid going into prison, because it could have been different. I was very fortunate that I was taken under the wing by prisoners who were seeking to fight for freedom as opposed to fight for who's going to be the toughest prisoner in the camp.
I was just going to say, and from our side, I'll speak a little bit, you know, for my mom can't be here to do so. From our side, it started out that we felt like this was this awful, horrible thing that happened to my brother, but we really didn't like it. It's just like, for us, it was just it was like an anomaly. Like, you know, we had never heard of this happening to, you know, a child before, you know, being sentenced to life, being threatened with the death penalty. And it was just, that was more what it was. And so, you know, my mom was getting support in terms of support of other parents who had incarcerated, you know, children or family members and things like that. And she would go to legislators to try and get, you know, help or to get sympathy. And, you know, that didn't do any good. But it was my brother's, when he began to educate himself and read and learn about this issue and about, you know, juvenile life without parole and about what the United States was doing that the rest of the world, or most of the rest of the world, wasn't doing. And it was him that began to educate us and sending us information about, you know, juvenile life without parole, about the Convention on the Rights of the Child and things like that. And it was just like, wow, like this was not just some horrible thing that happened to my brother. This is something that 2,000 other children have experienced. And, you know, and we're so lucky enough to be in the capital, the juvenile life without parole capital of the world, which is Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania had the most of anywhere else in the world. So then that was sort of a motivating, like, okay, this is not just this one thing that happened. This is something awful that's going on, you know, and people don't know it, you know, because, I mean, we were not, you know, unintelligent people, but we didn't know it. And I can tell you that, again, I started out being, my mom was the one more in the forefront, but then, you know, my brother would send me things and I'd start speaking and talking about the issues. And you go to legislators, and I can't tell you, legislators would sit there, tell me in my face, we didn't know what I was talking about. That they don't do that, right? That there is no mandatory life without parole for children in Pennsylvania. That it's only used for the worst of the worst of the worst. And we'd have to educate our own legislators here in Pennsylvania that no, that's not what the law is, and that it is mandatory, and there is no age. It doesn't start at a certain age that a child would be automatically sent to, first of all, to adult court, and then would have to petition to go back to juvenile court if it were, you know, felony. So it was, you know, in some ways it felt good in a way. I mean, it was a horrible realization to know that this was how bad this was and this was going on. But it was something to cling to say, okay, you know, at least we can try to do something here. Where it just felt so hopeless, like, you know, we felt hopeless, not the situation of, so what can you really do?
Yeah, they woke up a family to the facts that didn't take stuff lying down, but to other families who didn't have the background or the perspective to say, wait a minute, I didn't know this happened, but it's wrong, you know, for those other thousands of children whose parents are struggling but don't know which steps to take, right? The Holbrook family became a force, right? But other families just didn't have that option because of the makeup, right? It's not no harm, no foul, but you just don't have the wherewithal to pull.
Well, that's why, you know, organizations like, you know, my mother had been involved in one of the members of Fight for Lifers in Pennsylvania. You know, I took over and served on that, you know, board after she could no longer be a part of it. And so we did engage and reach out to families and people going through these situations to try to help and be their voice, and, you know, and show them whether it's how to write letters, how to write petitions, how to best support their loved ones behind bars. So, you know, it definitely, this journey, this fight has been, there are many facets, but a huge piece of it has been the support of other family members, like, you know, like me, like us, that we're going through the same thing, you know, in Pennsylvania and across the country.
Salim, so were you released because the Supreme Court ruled that putting juveniles in life, that's how you got out, was because,
yeah,
was that just the federal Supreme Court or the Pennsylvania Supreme
Court? That was the United States Supreme Court. Pennsylvania Supreme Court actually
denied,
ruled that it was non-retroactive. And so Pennsylvania still, you know, I wrote, actually at the time after Pennsylvania ruled that the United States Supreme Court decision that children could not be sentenced to mandatory life without paroles was non-retroactive. And so it didn't apply to the 400 of us in Pennsylvania. It only applied going forward to people. I remember I was saying, like, Pennsylvania reminded me of the old Governor Wallace from Alabama, who stood in front of the schoolhouse saying segregation now, segregation today, and segregation forever. I wrote an article saying that's basically what Pennsylvania Supreme Court said when they tried to defy that United States Supreme Court ruling. Now, it went back in front of the United States Supreme Court, and they clarified that this is retroactive and states have to abide by it for people who are currently serving those sentences.
And that brought you your freedom.
That brought you the opportunity for a resentencing. Yeah.
It made me eligible for a resentencing hearing to show the court that I was I'm not the person I was when I was 16 years old when I committed this offense. And what I've accomplished in the 27 years that I was in prison. And I mean, I had tremendous community support. I had the support of my sentencing judge, wrote a letter who said that if he had a choice in my sentence, because he didn't, it was a mandatory sentence. He said he certainly wouldn't have sentenced me to life without parole to spend the rest of my life in prison. So, and as a result of that sentencing hearing, I was resentenced to 27 years to life. Now I'm still on lifetime parole, which is a whole nother story, but you know, our objective was to get out, not get caught up in too many of the details. It was, you know.
Right. It must seem like it's much easier to fight some of these battles free than
fight from out here.
Yeah.
On the inside. But that's what resulted in my release. And one thing you shared earlier, that we certainly were some of the more maybe prominent faces of the Life Without Parole movement in Pennsylvania, but it was a large movement. That's one thing. On the inside, we were organizing in every prison. And on the outside, there were many family members across the state. Now, Anita was the state coordinator for the national campaign for the fair sentencing of youth. And so she was like the spokesperson for family members of juvenile lifers in Pennsylvania. But I will say that it was a movement. It was definitely a large movement that grew out of this unjust sentence. And it was also an international movement because my sister went to Geneva to testify as part of a delegation to the United Nations about the sentence violating the human rights of
convention of convention on the rights of the child.
So
fast forward to you, my brother being home and going to Geneva and testifying about that.
So
can you tell us a little bit about that growth in prison? I mean, 27 years. The other thing, obviously, is a big part of what you and I first talked about was trying to eliminate solitary confinement. As it blew my mind when one of the legislators that was interviewing you called it a tool. We need the tool of solitary confinement, as though, I mean, I always think of tools as something that's positive, right? You got a tool to fix the dishwasher, but there seems to be nothing positive, and certainly not from the testimony of the one man who had done four tours in the Marines and in the military, and he said the mental anguish he suffered in solitary confinement was worse than four tours.
Yeah, that was Reverend Chris Jimenez, friend, a Marine, and he, you know, his testimony is really powerful, and it also just opens I do believe that it does open a glimpse, because some people are like, holy wow, this guy, it was in four tours of combat, and he's saying that he suffers more PTSD from 6 months in solitary confinement than four tours of combat. And that's the truth. I will tell you this, that out of the 27 years I served in prison, what impacts me the most is the 10 years in solitary confinement. I think the residue is still there for me, right? I remember a really jarring moment. Last year, I went to Alcatraz. I went out to California for a conference on solitary confinement, and I was out there, and I had a day to myself, and you know, I was like, I want to go over to Alcatraz. You know, my father, ironically, was part of the Alcatraz occupation in the 70s when the indigenous nations took it over. And so I called him and was like, I'm going to head over there just to, you know, check it out. And I remember touring Alcatraz, and we went down to the solitary units, and I went down and I stepped into the solitary cells. And as I stepped through the second gate, I started to go down to do a push-up. And I I had to catch myself, because my routine, as soon as I would be placed in the hole when I was in Pennsylvania, was as soon as they took the handcuffs off me and closed that aperture, I would immediately go down and just start working out that was what got me through solitary confinement. So it blew my mind that here I am home 7 years and I walk in this cell, and the cell was clean. It was like, it reminded me of the solitary cells at SCI Huntington that I did a lot of solitary time in, and just how my body just like adjusted to that environment so quickly, like in a millisecond. Cause I'm telling you, I walked through it and just, and so, you know, you are impacted by solitary confinement in ways that you don't even realize. I'm fortunate that I can reflect on it, but yeah, it was, the guards insist that they need it despite all the studies showing that it's not a tool that makes prisons safer. What it is, as I testified, it's a convenient tool, for lack of a better word, that they use. And the people who are primarily impacted by solitary confinement are people who are suffering from mental health disabilities, children and youth that come into out of the prison and have difficulty adjusting, and placing them in solitary confinement does not help them adjust. Trust me, I would have been a model prisoner if it helped, right? And it actually drives people insane. And the fact is that, look, I was serving life without parole. I'm fortunate to have slipped through the cracks, but 99% of the people who are going to prison are coming home. And you don't want them coming home worse than when they went.
Mentally.
Particularly mentally. And so many people I see living on the streets or in the subways in Philadelphia are people that were in solitary confinement with me in prison. So it's a dumping ground. It's a convenient so-called tool. It's inhumane. It doesn't necessarily make the prison safer. The prison always gives the example of, well, the prisoner who killed 4 people, what are we going to do? I'm like, look, okay, we live in the real world. If someone is killing people, what we're saying, we understand you need to isolate that person. That if they're the Hannibal Lecter that they always want to bring out. But the majority of people in solitary confinement, and they did a study, Vera Institute, that found that 85% of the people who are in solitary confinement are in solitary confinement for refusing to obey an order or other lesser offenses like unauthorized area, using a telephone without authorization. Those are the people who are in solitary confinement units predominantly. There's other ways that you can deal with infractions in prison: taking away yard time, taking away telephone time, taking away commissary privileges. And other prisons have done it and seen that that has been more effective in curbing disruptive behavior than placing someone in solitary confinement. But I also have to just be straight. I remember having the exchange with one of the legislators. One thing I do realize about prison: if someone wants to do something to you, solitary confinement is not the deterrence. It's not. That's just how the environment is. As they say, you're going to get got if someone has a problem with you. People are not worried about that, because in prison, you're more worried about the perception of other prisoners or the consequences of other prisoners if you look weak or if you don't do something to someone. So you would rather spend 2 years in solitary confinement for harming someone that disrespected you or did something to you, then not harm them and face the wrath of that prison environment looking like a weakling and being victimized every day. And that's what I try and explain to a lot of the legislators and prison guards. Even know it themselves when you really talk to them, like, yeah, these guys, if they're more concerned about the consequences of prisoners than 2 years in solitary confinement, because they got to be here 10, 20, 15 years. And that could be a rough stretch. So those are things that I wish we could honestly talk about, as opposed to solitary confinement being a tool that curbs behavior, because it doesn't. It drives people insane. It costs the money. It costs the state incredible amount of money to maintain these units. And it also, I'll say this too, and I'll step on the other side. Guards that work in solitary confinement also have the highest rates of suicide, divorce, alcoholism, and PTSD. So it cuts both ways.
Yeah.
It inhumanizes both sides. And one thing I'll give you an example is in prison, if there is a lenient guard, whether it's a man or especially if it's a woman, they take them and put them on the worst solitary units and have them work back there. And what that does is it's so much abuse. It's such a tense environment going both ways between prisoner and guard that they come out, most of them, a different person, right? So it changes everyone that has to work in that environment.
One of the interviews I had with one of the legislators who was hugely four square in your back, you know, in your corner on this whole thing. And they're shockingly few legislators that'll say the system's not working. We wouldn't have more people incarcerated in the world than any other country if we had a good system. We'd be, you know, it's a failure of the system that people suffer recidivism. It's not if the system worked, they wouldn't be doing it. But one of the things said is the contraband people are being punished for isn't being brought in by the inmates.
Totally, it's not.
It's all being brought in by the guards. And so Pennsylvania had a huge scandal a couple of years before you testified, and a whole pile of guards went down. That's why they only had an acting director of the Correctional Officers Union, is because the director had just been caught for doing all this corrupt and inappropriate behavior as the head of the union. So it's a criminal enterprise that feeds off criminals. the criminal justice system.
Absolutely. It's a racket. I tell you what, me and guys that did a lot of time in prison, we sometimes sit around and was like, man, we went into the wrong racket. We should have been these politicians and been these guards, administrators, because they are screwing everybody over big time. I mean, it's like, I hate to say it, look at like Donald Trump, look at all them. Like sometimes, yeah, well, we went into the wrong racket, you know, but, you know, the truth of the matter is prisons is the dumping ground for dregs of society. And if we would spend as much money helping our fellow citizen, our fellow people, as we do pumping into this failed project of mass incarceration, our communities would be much better. Because here's the thing, and again, I'm going to say this, if mass incarceration resulted in safe communities, the United States would be the Singapore of the world, but we're not. If anything, we're Westernized countries, we're the worst when it comes to violence, when it comes to homelessness, when it comes to police brutality. We're at the bottom social indicators, education, everything. You can't separate that from how much this country invests in mass incarceration as opposed to invest in its communities. Black communities, brown communities, white communities, whatever communities you come from. When we talk about defunding police or ending mass incarceration, we are talking about taking those taxpayer dollars that you are paying that are going into this failed project and putting them back in your pocket, in your community, so we can make our communities collectively better. And I would rather us experiment, throw some things on the wall, and utilize proven practices to get to that point than to keep dumping this money into this failed system. And that's the challenge to talk to people about and to get them to see why ending mass incarceration is important. Just because you may not be locked up or your loved one may not be locked up, mass incarceration impacts you. It's the reason why you don't have universal healthcare. It's the reason why you don't have childcare. It's the reason why your taxes are high. It's the reason why you can't afford that mortgage. All of this is connected to the amount of money we pump into prisons and policing and mass incarceration in this country.
That's one of the things, too, that I really respect about what you're doing with the Abolitionist Law Center is you're taking an active role in doing this. And I would really like you to talk a little bit about how all that Abolitionist Law Center came about and like, what was the motivation for that form of activism? Because I'm amazed at some of the cases that have been taken on by the Abolitionist Law Center.
I mean, certainly. I mean, the one thing is that we're going to take on the cases and the issues that are not popular. We're going to take on the controversial cases, and we're going to be the underdog. And because that's our background, like I said, Abolitionist Law Center started as an inside-outside collaboration between activists like myself who were incarcerated and activists on the outside, like Brett Grody, Dustin McDaniel, my sister, Jamila Morgan, and there's dozens of others, Ms. Patricia Vickers, who were part of this larger movement that was advocating for the human rights of prisoners, but also too, who are advocating for the voices of prisoners' families and the communities we come from, saying, one, these sentences that our loved ones are serving are unjust, and two, it's not working. It's not making our communities safer. We want something different. We want something better. And the Abolitionist Law Center emerged from that soil. The work that we do revolves around several prongs. Like I like to tell people, we fight the carceral state, what we call the carceral state, from the front end to the back end. And that means everything from arrest, pretrial detention, trial, conviction, post-conviction, conditions of confinement, supervision, anything dealing with state surveillance, the state suppressing your individual liberty, we deal with that. Now, that doesn't mean we don't believe in accountability. We believe in accountability. We believe if you harm someone, you should be held accountable. What we believe is that the methods that are being used are not holding the people accountable. They're punishing people, but punishment didn't hold me accountable. Punishment didn't make me the person who I am. If anything, I could have lived in that perpetual cycle of punishment and thrived in it, right? But I broke from it and had looked at myself, and I was fortunate to be part of an ecosystem or a movement that helped me hold myself accountable and become a better person. So the work that we do, though, you know, the work around ending solitary confinement is dear to us because so many of us were in solitary confinement. Ending life without parole, death by incarceration sentences is very important to us. Ending supervised long-term supervision is important to us. Making sure that people who are in prison are treated with respect and dignity is very important to us. Making sure that police are held accountable for their actions in our communities is very important to us. Making sure that politicians are held accountable is extremely important to us because politicians determine so much of our social life and our cultural life and our well-being. So that's an area. And we use litigation, we use community organizing to achieve those goals. And we organize people on the margins because as we look at this society, we are seeing that more and more of working class people have been pushed to the margins of society. And what we are trying to do is push people back to the center, that working class people. So we want to create a more just and equitable society. And we also recognize that Black people have historically been wronged in this country and have disproportionately suffered the impact of this rabid capitalism that has been imposed on the world. And I know people are like, oh my God, here we go with this socialist, right? You know who's the biggest socialist right now in this country? Elon Musk. Is the Warren Buffett, right? Jeff Bezos, they're socialists. It's only us working class folks or people who don't understand what socialism means who are so opposed to it, right? Yeah, Elon Musk and them, they're socialists. They are benefiting the government from the government. They're Warren Buffett, they are benefiting from the government. Donald Trump is benefiting from his merger from the government taking care of him. That's why he pays $700 in income tax one year, more than all of us, right? I mean, less than all of us. So we want to invert that, man. We want to change the society. We know that we have a lot of work to do, but why we're centered in litigation and law is because that is the soil that we grew in. That has been the terrain that we fought in, remedying those injustices. Ruthie Gilmore Johnson said that mass incarceration, if you study its history, really is massive warfare on the working class in this country. And that's what it is. And so we're trying to push that back. And, you know, in Pennsylvania, we're at the forefront of it. And yeah, it makes strange bedfellows to be in this space sometimes because we have to, you know, work inside, outside. I tell people all the time, yeah, I have to go to these hearings to talk to Republicans, to talk to Democrats, to change their minds and sometimes change their hearts. But our greatest success has been through litigation and moving institutions through community power. That is what we believe. Politicians don't do anything out of the goodness of their heart. They don't do anything about out of the kindness of their heart. They do it because you can move them. And I think that rings true regardless to where you stand on the political spectrum. I just feel like for us, for Black people, brown people, for working class people in this country, we've been on the opposite side of that, right? We haven't been able to move these politicians to create this type of society that we want to live in. So yeah, so that's, you know, that's, that, I know I was kind of all over the place with that, but you know, that's what the Abolitionist Law Center emerged from. And that's what our work is motivated by. The day-to-day work is, like I said, like litigation, community advocacy, traveling across the state, talking to prisoners and their families.
I did have one other question because I did get a hold of the copy of the book Behind the Mountain from City Lights Books, and you contributed an essay to that that I found fascinating. Could you speak to that?
Yes, it's the name of the book is Beneath the Mountain.
Oh, sorry.
Yes. Yeah, that essay I wrote on Dismantling the Master's House was, I kind of was given a glimpse into how we look at the law. And I know Pat's going to laugh at this. Like, we look at the law as a tool in our abolitionist toolbox, right? So often the law is used to harm us, take something from us, right? We want to use the law to defend ourselves and increase our rights, right? So for me, being 16 years old, going into the prison, I knew that I had to learn the law because it was trying to kill me, right? It wanted to keep me in prison for the rest of my life. And so as a kid, I went to the law library, and I'll be honest with you, it was like reading Chinese for a while. But eventually I was able to work my way up to the point. Today, I teach law at the University of Penn, right? I didn't go to law school. I was mentored by other prisoners in how to utilize the law to assert my rights in an environment that was using the law to suppress my rights, as well as asserting my rights to freedom and dignity, which was the most important. But I also understood that those laws had limitations, right? That it had to be much more. And so I didn't put all my eggs in one basket and say, just the law is going to get me out. That's where we built a movement to complement the law. And that ties into what ALC is today. ALC is an arm of a larger abolitionist and social justice movement in Pennsylvania that utilizes the law, but also utilizes community organizing, community advocacy, networking, and building power within these communities. So what I really wanted to do was to give a glimpse that, yes, we do use the law, that, yes, the law can be used to dismantle unjust and oppressive institutions, but there does have to be more than just a reliance on litigation and the law. And then more importantly, I really wanted to go to the source, because for me, it was the liberation movements that use the law to free themselves, right? Nelson Mandela was a lawyer, right? So that was someone also that inspired me. So I really wanted to just center abolition and social justice in law, because so often law can be used to roll back social justice, to roll back people's rights. And I believe that the law should progress. It should extend, it should grant. And I believe that anyone who is working class, anyone who is on the margins of society should want more, should want to fight for more. And that is what we intend to do with the law.
So that's a perfect segue to, I don't know about you, but the incoming administration has me a little worried. The current United States Supreme Court has me a little worried. It was the United States Supreme Court that granted you your freedom. And I am very afraid that a different Supreme Court will take other people's freedom away. So how do people get involved? How can they start participating in the work that you do?
Certainly. Well, I'm definitely going to just do the social media plug and be like, you know, you can follow us on Facebook at Abolitionist Law Center, Instagram, Twitter. We're also on Blue Sky now as we're moving off of apartheid baby Elon Musk X Twitter platform, whatever you call it. I mean, we're still going to have a presence there. But so that's some of the ways that you could get involved. We also have an organization called or a coalition called Free Our People that if you go to our website, you can sign up for, and this will allow you to plug into virtual meetings that we have around ending mass incarceration, political education. And we also do legislative visits with legislators around issues of importance, whether it's solitary confinement, life without parole, ending long-term parole supervision. I mean, we also advocate for victims' rights. You know, we want more resources to go into victim services. What we don't want is victims used for vengeance and retribution. We want victims to be actually healed and supported as opposed to being used as props by district attorneys. So those are ways that you could get involved in our work. So, you know, just you could follow the Abolitionist Law Center. You could follow our C4 Toward Abolition on Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, as well as Twitter. And it will plug you into our work. And you could also follow me. I'm on those platforms as well.
And so this is these are all links, Max, that you'll be putting on the website, on the Sacred Legion's website.
Yeah, I will be looking specifically for ways to volunteer to help out because I love that activism part of it. And that's part of what we're trying to encourage with Sacred Legions is to encourage volunteerism amongst our followers and to encourage self-care amongst our followers. And so both of those things are really important. So, yeah, absolutely. I want to have those resources for our listeners on the website.
Anita, do you want to throw something in for you'd like to?
I mean, you know, obviously, you know, all of the organizations and things that my brother named are good. You know, I will put a plug in just specifically around the issue of juvenile life without parole, which we've made a lot of progress, you know, with 1,100 and I think 90 individuals have come home now that were sentenced to die in, you know, in prison as children. Wow. So that's really exciting, you know, but it's only a little more than half of where, you know, we need to be. And, you know, even though the Supreme Court decision said that it can't be mandatory, it didn't take it away. A lot of people think like it doesn't exist. Yes, children are still being sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. It just made the steps a little bit, you know, more difficult in some cases to do it. So the Campaign for Fair Sentencing of Youth is an organization that's been around for 15 years now that I was in the beginning when it started. As my brother mentioned, I was the state coordinator when we were just trying to begin to advocate around this. I now chair the board of directors for the Campaign for Fair Sentencing of Youth. So wonderful organization. So it also encourage those that are interested, you know, particularly in juvenile life without parole to look up the website and get involved.
Wonderful. Well, thank you. It's been a remarkable program and I look forward to hearing more and chatting with you more. I know, Salim, you have a lot of stuff on your plate for the upcoming legislative term in Pennsylvania and we'll be covering that hopefully at the Bucks County Beacon where I write. That's my day job. And Max, thanks. Fun show as usual. It was really informative and really quite an honor.
Well, and thank you again to Salim and Anita. And I have had so much fun as I always do. And I am so pleased that you were willing to join us today. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, Pat. Pleasure.
For having us.
Sacred Legions is a production of Sacred Legions LLC. It is hosted by Max Goler and Pat LaMarche. It's produced by Pat LaMarche. It's recorded and edited by Max Goler. Original music provided by Jammin' Jamie Callan. For more Sacred Legions episodes, visit our website, www.sacredlegions.org, or check us out on your favorite podcast service.